We often look up at the stars and ask, if the universe is so big and ancient, why aren't there big and ancient civilizations spanning the galaxy? But what if they are, and they are just asleep? It's been a while since we visited the Fermi Paradox directly on this channel, and it's probably overdue. In the past, we've looked at almost every solution folks have presented about the Fermi Paradox, but there's one group of solutions we've mostly skipped. A variation known as the estivation hypothesis has developed within that group since the last time we discussed the Fermi Paradox, so now seems like a good time to look at these solutions more in depth. Interestingly, this also happens to be a category of solutions that predates the Fermi Paradox itself. The Fermi Paradox is fundamentally a response to our deepening understanding of the antiquity of our world and the evolutionary path of life on it, coupled with the realization that our galaxy hosts hundreds of billions of stars, which makes up less than a billionth of all the stars in the visible universe. That took a long time to sink into our collective consciousness, and it really wasn't until we were taking our first steps toward designing spaceships that it slammed home. Yet many years before that happened, some folks were considering it. One of those was H.P. Lovecraft, best known for his Cthulhu mythos, but not very well known in his time, probably because these ideas hadn't really had time to sink in. This brings us to our Audible Book of the Month, H.P. Lovecraft's At the Mountains of Madness. This is one of the best-known stories that began that mythos, focusing on the discovery of a truly ancient and alien civilization found in the depths of Antarctica, whose existence covers vast amounts of space and time. This is one of our earliest examples in fiction of trying to come to terms with the idea that if life can arise naturally, with all the countless billions of worlds, many predating us by billions of years, there has to be a reason why they aren't seemingly everywhere. You can pick up a free copy of the story today, and also get a 30-day trial of Audible. Just use my link, audible.com/Isaac, or text Isaac to 500-500. A regular aspect of Lovecraft's work is that these ancient beings share nothing of our own worldview. They are not so much evil as operating under totally alien outlooks. That's important to the Fermi Paradox because our broadest group of possible solutions invariably revolve around alien behavior and motivation, and we don't want to make too many assumptions in that regard. Even just reading material written by fellow humans only a century or two old can reveal some huge differences in perspective and ethics, and I'll throw that in as a warning about our Book of the Month too. Anytime you read a classic, and many of our Books of the Month tend to be, you can encounter some shocking views, and that's especially the case for Lovecraft. For our purposes today, though, that's actually a bit of a benefit, because it serves as an example of just how much of a change a few generations can make to a single culture who shares the same traditions in biology. A truly alien mindset might easily be incomprehensible in its motives, though as we've discussed in regard to artificial intelligence, it will probably tend to be internally fairly logical and consistent. An AI might be more human than an alien, for having been made and raised by humans, or even more alien than actual aliens, since those should, presumably, share the same basic biological motives evolution would tend to pressure a species towards. However, I've often noted that classical evolution makes little sense once you get technology. If you extrapolate that out onto geological timelines, rather than just envisioning a species a few centuries ahead, you can end up with something just as detached from evolutionary roots as an AI would be, from centuries of genetic or cybernetic alteration. You can expect that they will be sufficiently logical, but in truth, folks already are, and we can see how irrational that often seems. As best as I can tell, just about every human who has ever lived has been logical. Their personal assumptions, training, experience, and worldview just flavor where that logic starts, how well it is performed, and where they subconsciously tend to steer it. If you begin with very alien biology and motivations, that can end at some very logical but mystifying behaviors and opinions. I wanted to stress that point because the Fermi Paradox has a vast number of suggested solutions, as we detailed in the Fermi Paradox Compendium, but most tend to fall into three broad categories. The first being that they don't exist, the second that we can't detect them, and the third that we can't recognize them. Even most of our solutions we had to classify as miscellaneous arguably weren't outside those three, but more of a hotbed between two or three categories. The first, that they don't exist, only relies on the motivation of the alien in a very minimal way. It's the category for solutions ranging from life being very uncommon to intelligence evolving very rarely, but it also includes that we might be unnatural in origin, an extreme fluke of probability like a Boltzmann brain, any scenario where we were created by a god or aliens or computer programmers, or that we are natural enough but prone to killing ourselves off with our own technology. Both of those, unnatural origin and suicide by technology, do have a motivation component, though for the former, it is the creator's motivations that matter, not ours, and for the latter, it's more of a lack of clear perspective. You assume the folks wanted to survive, so they did not detect the threat, or could not bring themselves to recognize it. I'll get to the second category shortly, but first let's deal with the third category. That mostly contains similar examples. It's the one for things like aliens walking quietly among us, while we are unable to recognize they do, either through outright denial, or that we lack the context to even see it, as we could walk right past a sentient tree or stone and not realize they had thoughts. We don't see them doing anything to indicate intelligence, but we have to acknowledge that maybe their motives are simply so different that their actions appear as simple random noise or coincidence to us. A big swarm of mosquitoes that was actually a hive mind might, very logically, be motivated simply to gather blood and reproduce. Now, that example can be rebutted by pointing out that any sort of intelligence or network requires maintenance and resources, so if it isn't providing an obvious benefit, it probably should not exist. And since a big swarm of mosquitoes ought to act that way anyway, they derive no benefit from a hive mind directing them to do just that. When we get into the second category of solutions to the Fermi paradox, that we can't detect them, we do a lot of those kind of rebuttals. Someone says the universe is full of aliens, but they all keep small civilizations and hide them, and we examined that in the Hidden Aliens episode, and concluded that it was not a very logical survival strategy based on known science. Hence, it would be very weird for every alien species to do that. The Alien Civilization series differs from the Fermi Paradox episodes mostly in that it is entirely likely, even probable, that a lot of civilizations do try to hide. So in the Alien Civilization episodes, we can look at them, whereas in the Fermi Paradox episodes, we are not interested in such civilizations unless they offer a solution to the Fermi Paradox. And they don't, any more than an entire village hiding does if one member instead stands up on a hill with a beacon fire and a megaphone shouting out town gossip and census data. We call this exclusivity, or rather non-exclusivity, and it tends to poke holes in virtually every Category 2 solution. And indeed, today's case of sleeping civilizations is not entirely an exception. Maybe we can't detect aliens because they don't use radio in favor of something better. Beyond radio being the detection method the SETI Institute likes to suggest, it's just one of many methods which would not be interfered with by better communication systems. This still ignores that you'd expect at least one civilization to maintain a classic radio beacon just to say, "Greetings, new species, welcome to the galaxy." Exclusivity is simultaneously a tricky concept and a simple one. Interstellar travel should be exclusive to species that understand basic math and physics, since it's hard to make rocket ships, let alone fusion or antimatter drives without it. Alternatively, we could not say space travel is exclusive to democracies or a particular economic system, since the entire space race was essentially a proxy war between two ideologies with polar opposite views on such matters, and both achieved great successes. We can say space travel ought to be exclusive to folks who understand algebra, but not that it is exclusive to capitalists or communists, democracies or oligarchies, benevolent dictators or military despots, theists or atheists, and so on. We might be able to say it is exclusive to folks who value technology, as we not expect Luddites to do space, but even that's kind of dubious. One only needs to embrace the technology specifically necessary for travel, and even then, just the blueprints, not the science behind them, and a civilization might embrace science and then turn against it. Similarly, we couldn't completely rule out something evolving in space, big space squid that hatch from small asteroids, and go floating around sucking up sunlight and asteroids and space dust for fuel. Or say a race of critters with mystic mind powers who teleport to other worlds but couldn't do trigonometry. This mostly doesn't matter to the Fermi paradox, though, because such routes seem improbable enough that odds are, even if they maybe do exist somewhere in the universe, they are rare enough not to impact the solution. So our example for today is civilizations that go to sleep. And at first, from groundwork we've just laid, this seems as easily dismissed as most other Category 2 concepts. If civilizations sleep, what the heck is their motive for doing so? And why would all of them do it? And we would say there isn't any, and move on, simply saying some might, but most wouldn't, and thus it's not a good Fermi paradox solution. However, we recently had a solution provided that does provide a motivation for going to sleep, called estivation hypothesis, which we'll discuss in a moment. It's not a good Fermi paradox solution itself, we'll go ahead and model it shortly, but it is an interesting approach and got me challenging my assumption about sleeping civilizations in general. But first, let's discuss estivation hypothesis. It came out in 2017, a year after both the Compendium episode was done and the First Civilizations at the End of Time episode. And appropriately, the paper by Anders Sandborg and others on this is titled, "That is not dead which can eternal lie," which is a quote from H.P. Lovecraft's Necronomicon, a fictional work mentioned in some of his stories and popularized a lot nowadays. The basic assumption is simple enough. A lot of futurists tend to assume that thinking processes will eventually shift from neurons, or whatever an alien might use, over to a computer substrate. Don't confuse that with artificial intelligence. An AI might run on a computer, but so can a game of solitaire or your brain. The basic reasoning is that whether you are using a physical deck of cards or one on the screen, you are still playing solitaire. And so too, whether your brain runs on neurons or computers as its substrate, it is still a human brain. Build a house of stone or brick or wood or Lego, and it is still a house, same reasoning. Not everyone agrees, but that's the concept. Now, a neuron doesn't work better when you make it cold, it eventually dies and freezes, but computational processes generally do better when it's colder. And we actually have something called Landauer's principle, which shows the maximum processing a computer can do with a bit of energy is inverse to temperature. This adds nothing new to the discussion of the Fermi paradox, and it's often been suggested civilizations might migrate beyond the galactic rim to where things are cooler to take advantage of that. Indeed, that was one of the miscellaneous solutions we discussed in the compendium. Such civilizations are obviously hard for us to see. They'd be tens of thousands of light years away and might be fairly covert. They might have ridden out there on suns, converted into Chicago thrusters and then into Matryoshka brains. They might be decentralized with each spread out to a small asteroid to help with cooling, or even built up into a big centralized birch planet, but we'd have problems seeing them now regardless. Back in the Civilizations at the End of Time episode, Black Hole Farming, done just a bit after the compendium, we pointed out that while the period after all the stars had died off would be the era of the universe with the most entropy and the least free energy available, the expanding and cooling universe would permit computation at such cold temperatures that you might run entire civilizations off what you need to run a light bulb in our time. There will be very little energy available, but you can do so much more computing or thinking and simulating with it. The estivation hypothesis, and estivation means to hibernate or enter torpor, works on this same reasoning. You put your whole civilization to sleep until temperatures cool down so that you can take advantage of those super cold temperatures and live then, when there's less free energy but you can do far, far more with it. Now that is a great motivation from the Fermi paradox perspective. It's very easy to argue that most civilizations tend to shift to the computer substrate. It's way more efficient and way better for colonizing space, too. It also offers simple immortality, as you can easily repair and replace everything. You can also run your brain faster to experience whole days in mere seconds, or slow it down to experience a mere second over a whole century. This unglues you from classic time, and I want to emphasize that because it's what hit me later on, when I was pondering this more. If you live this way, you only have two relevant calendars, your internal one of experiences, and your civilization around you. For the most part, the natural world and the universe are not dominating how you experience time anymore. So you can just slow down, I don't think you'd completely stop, since you need to monitor the rest of the universe, and wait until the universe cools down to more effectively use your energy. It sounds like a solid theory, as everyone should have a motivation to do this, and while doing it would appear non-interactive and quiet. However, as I said, we were going to murder it, and that's because it has three big flaws. First, the whole point of waiting till the end of time to use your resources is you get vastly more bang for your buck doing so. But that implies you'd like to have a stockpile of resources. If you're aiming for hyper-efficiency, you should be resource hoarding, and that results in the same basic Dyson dilemma we so often discuss. Whether you are using every rock and planet and star for resources and power, or are simply storing them away, it should look more or less the same. A dark universe where there are no stars because they waste energy, and indeed inhibit processing speed. That's the very reason you consider migrating to the galactic rim, because galaxies have a lot more heat in them than the intergalactic void, on account of all the bright stars illuminating it, and all the collisions going on. Nor are those resources static. They are going to get used up while you wait. So by default, such a civilization, before it goes to sleep, ought to spread over its galaxy and grab everything to store it securely for the eons to come, as they'll actually get to those lower temperatures faster by doing so, and ensure more energy and resources to use when that time comes. That's a fatal kill to the hypothesis right there. We would notice what is effectively a K3 civilization with the lights out. But there's also our second flaw, which is that you have to worry about alien civilizations arising and taking the galaxy while you sleep. It does no good to wait to harvest space if you wake up and find somebody else already has, and even if you had all the resources you want, that doesn't mean that they do. You could leave triggers in place to wake up, or more likely just keep at least some of your civilization awake or just slow down, but you would have to deal with that new civilization in some way, and even if it's a peaceful accord to divide up resources, all those leftover, ungathered resources are presumably spawning new civilizations you'd need to wake up and deal with, too. Then there's our third, which is exclusivity. We don't know that every species will converge towards this just because it seems logical, and more to the point, we shouldn't assume every member of a species does. That's just as important for any exclusivity issue with the Fermi paradox. Not just, will all species do this, but will every piece of their civilization feel the same? A trillion aliens in an empire who all believe it's wrong to contact a primitive species might not do so, but it only takes a handful of them, maybe even just one, to send a hello signal or maybe even visit in a ship. Similarly, most of a planet's inhabitants might feel colonizing space is wrong, but if some faction is very expansionist and does so, in a few centuries they won't be a small minority anymore. But the true new civilization, of which the non-expansionists are a tiny minority of antiques. So if 99% of a civilization goes to sleep while 1% does not, and instead goes around colonizing, it will only be a millennium or two before that sleeping 99% has become just 1% of some vast new empire, and millions or billions of years later, just some forgotten relic. On astronomical timelines, any pro-growth section of a civilization will utterly erase no-growth sections of it, all things being equal. So on first inspection, the estivation hypothesis seems dead on arrival. Indeed, in its default form, it mostly is. However, the Lovecraftian title of the paper nagged at my mind, and I started thinking about some of the other late filters we've discussed. Late filters being solutions to the Fermi paradox, which hit a civilization after they've reached our stage, like killing yourself off by artificial intelligence, or inventing a brainwashing technique that a unified empire uses to discourage colonization so as to ensure they create no external threats, or a convergence to a hive mind that does the same, never breaking itself up to colonize far away where communication lag time would prevent the extension of that mind and again create potential external threats. Let me talk about galactic harvesting though really quick. I say harvest everything now because it gets you maximum energy, but in truth, if you've got a civilization with a tech and inclination to use black holes for energy, not all that much is lost by stars burning, and it does take a lot of effort to acquire it all now. If you were locked into the idea of having a static population of, say, a billion minds, all kept near at hand to avoid serious mutation from the normal, creating more and sending them out around the galaxy is potentially spawning enemies. Over time, those galaxies in the local group, bound to us gravitationally, will all fall together without losing much mass to radiation and collapse into various black holes. You'd still have to retrieve them or set up shop around them, but as we discussed in Black Hole Farming, in such eras you are already running so slow that while it takes thousands of years for a signal to reach between two spots, it would seem like real time. That epoch is so long that even running at such slow speeds, you will experience a total subjective time that makes the entire lifetime of the current universe seem like an eye blink, so it doesn't matter to you. I pictured thousands of black holes scattered across the remnants of the galaxy, each home to either a civilization or a single supermind, slowly experiencing a near eternity, but able to speak to each other in what seemed no delay at all. Now that doesn't help with alien civilizations arising and taking resources, but let's consider another scenario. It's billions of years ago, and they are the first on the galactic scene, these old ones. Ethics vary, and we'll say they are rather repugnant in that purist and genocidal kind of way, but they firmly believe their civilization is essentially perfect and should tolerate no threats or distorted imitations. They know that if they go out and colonize the galaxy, those splinter civilizations will likely eventually become every bit as alien as actual aliens. You don't trust anything smart enough, be it one of your own or some AI you've made, to go harvest the galaxy and bring it back. So anyone you send out is either dialed down to near stasis, experiencing virtually no time at all, or too dumb to do much. No self-replicating machines or clever members of your species sent out to harvest the stars and decide to keep the resources for themselves while they are busy, awake and harvesting and contemplating. So you opt to only gather up resources from nearby, to live only nearby, and to mostly sleep until the day comes that you can enjoy the benefits of super slow, super cool, ultra-efficient computing, where anyone sent out would be forced to experience time slowly anyway, because it's the nature of such ultra-cool computing that you actually have to wait a long time between each use of a circuit so it can cool back down again on its own. Nobody left around is thinking that fast, with a huge energy penalty paid to run hotter, and communication lag time is eliminated by everyone experiencing time slowly, which helps with isolation mutation. Yes, you are losing a lot of resources to time marching on, and stars burning out or getting ejected from the galaxies, but not that much, and if it means you maybe only get a tenth of the total resources in the end, but only need a billion people to gather them, you are still ahead of the game proportionally by 100 million-fold. To them, the old ones, it doesn't matter how many resources their civilization has, but how many each of them individually gets and can use, and having to share with or fend off many others is not beneficial to that cause, because all they really care about is how long, subjectively, they can experience life. It doesn't really matter if this is a billion individuals, a hive of a billion minds, or a thousand supercomputers, or even just one big one, just so long as all share the motivation of their continued existence for as long as possible as the most important thing, and that any threat to that must be eliminated. That's important because it gives them the motivation to eliminate such threats, to kill off any emerging new species elsewhere, or to shoot down their own colony ships from deviants seeking to colonize the galaxy. They police the galaxy with very stupid probes, ones just smart enough to detect civilizations emerging anywhere in the local group of galaxies. Then they deal with them. There's many ways to do this, we'll discuss some in the upcoming Interstellar Warfare episode. But maybe the probe carries a copy of one of their minds forced asleep, who can only fully awaken when it either gets a go-ahead signal from home, or the conditions of that discovered civilization reach a specific marker where if it waits any longer, it won't be able to handle them, thus decreasing the risk of a rogue agent doing its own thing. Any interstellar-capable vessel could easily wipe us out right as we are now, all on its own. It's inherent to either the power levels needed for interstellar trips or the automation needed. But the key notion is that they don't want that sleeping giant to wake up until the last minute or one drop more than needed because they view it as just as nearly as big a threat as an enemy. They don't want it experiencing, thinking, contemplating, and acting far from home. going native to protect the locals after monitoring them for eons, or deciding to set itself up as a new rival civilization. So instead of the classic genocide approach of hitting everyone as early as possible, of even colonizing every planet so nothing new and alien can arise, they have a motive to wait until right now. Such a probe might not even have a mind, simply making itself easy to find, and includes flawed blueprints for a suicide pact technology, one that seems an amazing find, like a new power source, but kills your entire civilization if you use it. In that way, you ensure all threats, or the need to share the galaxy, is eliminated with the minimum risk, and you still keep yourself big enough that you can go wake up and attack them en masse if Plan A fails. You are already at the technological limit. You wouldn't go to sleep until you were pretty confident you figured out every cool and useful bit of science and technology that could help you be more efficient and safe. And you probably did gather up a lot of resources too, just not the whole galaxy. You might just live in one system, a single Dyson swarm, or even one planet, though it might be a gigantic Borch planet made by cannibalizing hundreds of thousands of nearby systems with automated mining. So if your preventative measures fail, you can still wake up and attack with a giant and super advanced armada, even if they might have had tens of thousands of years to grow and advance themselves. This does not necessarily require a particularly Lovecraft-flavored set of aliens, but it does bring to mind ancient, selfish, sleeping, and cruel ones. But it gets around exclusivity by requiring only that they be the first on the scene. I would not qualify it as a strong Fermi Paradox solution. It does not really pass the Dyson Dilemma test for explaining an absence of K3 civilizations in the local supercluster, just the local group, unless such behavior was more the norm than an exception that just arrived on the scene before anyone with a different mindset. However, I can't dismiss it as an implausible one either. This hybrid of estivation hypothesis and the more classic space opera notion of old and cold aliens waking up occasionally to slaughter the galaxy, as with the Reapers from Mass Effect and many other stories. That's what is so potent about Cthulhu mythos even a century after it was written. Not just the classic dangerous sleeping predator hiding in its dark cave and emerging occasionally to hunt us, but that emerging awareness of just how huge and old the universe is. I tend to think that's why Lovecraft was not very successful as a writer while he lived, but is one of the best known authors nowadays, and is the sci-fi horror subgenre what Tolkien is to fantasy, or Asimov is to robot-centered sci-fi. We grew up in a world that few saw then, but we know all too well now. Robots aren't a novelty like in Asimov's time, and the vast age and scope of the universe, with possible ancient alien civilizations hanging around, isn't something that only really was understood by a handful of astronomers and hadn't sunk into public awareness yet. We know how old and big space is. We know that the chemistry for life ought to be fairly common. And we know that the basic evolutionary mechanics of biology should tend to favor species that are fairly predisposed to seek to survive and grow their numbers, and their absence, and the Fermi Paradox, worries us. I think that Lovecraft was the first writer to really tackle that feeling, and needless to say, his writing doesn't encourage optimism. I disagree with that fear his works are best known for, but it does absolutely make for a great read, or listen, and has inspired countless authors and novels, from our Book of the Month a few months back, Alistair Reynolds' Revelation Space, to the master of modern horror, Stephen King, who cites him as his inspiration, and says no one has yet surpassed Lovecraft at tales of dread and horror. Of all of his works, I've picked At the Mountains of Madness as our Book of the Month because it also captures that feeling of exploration too, and we get to see humanity's brighter side as an expedition challenges themselves, reaching out to explore new realms, something we see as a common part of the best horror in that time, whether it was expeditions exploring the Antarctic or old tombs and pyramids, questing for ancient knowledge. There happen to be many versions of the story in abridged, unabridged, and radio drama forms, or in anthologies, one of the nice things about the classics. So I'd recommend searching through them for the narrator you like the most, as Audible does let you play a sample of each performance before grabbing it. You can pick up a free copy of At the Mountains of Madness today. Just use my link in the episode's description, audible.com/Isaac, or text promo code Isaac to 500-500 to get a free book and a 30-day free trial. And that book is yours to keep, whether you stay on with Audible or not. I won't say you are going to love it, as it is a horror story charting an expedition to a strange and barren place, but if you don't enjoy it, you can swap it out for another at any time. Next week, we'll be doing our own expedition to a strange and barren place, as we return to our Outward Bound series to look at colonizing Alpha Centauri, and we'll discuss both interstellar colonization and the special problems of binary and multiple star systems. From there, we'll move back home to look at how we can go about building up the orbital infrastructure we'll need to colonize space. And 3 weeks from now, we'll take another look at space warfare, and consider the special problems with doing that at the interstellar scale. And lastly, a month from now, we'll return to the Civilizations at the End of Time series, for Dying Earth, and what civilizations will do when the planet and the sun they've always depended upon begins to perish. For alerts when those and other episodes come out, make sure to subscribe to the channel. And if you enjoyed this episode, hit the like button and share it with others. Until next time, thanks for watching, and have a great week.